This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It stretches across 730 square miles, appearing as an unblinking blue eye on the map of Florida, Big Water, Lake Okeechobee. It occupies a principal position for fresh water throughout South Florida. The lake's waters are at the center of efforts to restore the Central Everglades. Over 3 years and with a $2 billion price tag, the Central Everglades Plan aims to redirect water coming out of the southern edge of Lake O, currently flowing east and west, and push it south into the heart of the River of Grass. But this week, a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers committee put a cork in the plan. The Corps' Civil Works Review Board did not approve redirecting the water, insisting it needs more time to review the plan. Can nature wait? Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald and Jenny Stiletovich from the Miami Herald joining me here on the Florida Roundup. Jenny, first of all, why did the Corps Review Board reject this plan when it has been approved at every level, including the South Florida Water Management District level, up until this week?
The Corps said that they need more time to review the plan, but when everyone asked what exactly you need to review, they did not provide a lot of details. And from the Water Management District to the governor's office to the environmentalists who have been working on this thing for 2.5 years, they're mystified. They say, we don't know what went wrong.
And the role of the Corps here is the management of Lake Okeechobee itself. So it is key. That is the reservoir that holds the water that the Central Everglades Restoration Plan counts on.
Well, the Corps and the it's a joint partnership, mm-hmm. and so that needs federal money and state money. The Water Management District earlier this month committed to paying their half, but they need the Corps to approve the project so that it can then move into Congress in an appropriations and be placed into an appropriations bill. And that was the big deadline hanging over everyone's head, is this water resources and the WERDA bill. I'm sorry to forget what the acronym is.
Yeah, that's right, because it was about water management, not only with the Corps, but that also involves Port Everglades and many, many other projects.
Right,
WERDA
is a
national plan.
National plan. It's got projects from all over the country in it. The Central Everglades plan was just one of many, but The Army Corps needed, their Civil Works Review Board needed to sign off on this so that it could make it in time into WERDA. There's a mini step in between that, which is, it's not a mini step, it's a big step. The Chief of Engineer, mm-hmm. who runs the Corps, has to sign off on it. So they needed to review it to get it to the Chief so he could sign off on it in time, and that didn't happen.
Mark, the science involved here is relatively simple compared to the politics. Two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen, and it flows downhill, and where it goes after Lake O is the source of the debate. Is there politics involved here?
There's probably politics in everything. You know, man by nature is a political animal. But when it comes to the Army Corps of Engineers, you really can't underestimate its history of delay and obfuscation. It's just, I mean, for decades, it's ever since it's been going on, it's difficult to get a straight answer out of them. Mm-hmm. You know, the governor can't get a straight answer out of them.
Yeah, Governor Scott, in fact, said that he was extremely disappointed in this review board's plan.
And for Governor Scott, that's a lengthy statement.
Yeah.
he's known for being pretty laconic. But this is not complicated stuff. The idea of Everglades restoration, which is a misnomer, it's really replumbing, is to stack water for future development, mm-hmm. and for the environment. And also, you know, the Army Corps helps see these programs or promulgate these rules about when they eject water from Lake Okeechobee and when they don't. And of course, when it gets too wet and they eject the water through the St. Lucie River and through the Caloosahatchee, it poisons stuff. So that doesn't stop them. So the idea that, oh, we don't want to cause environmental damage. Well, hell, you've been causing it since 1947.
And significant damage just last year alone with the wet rainfall that we had last spring, Jenny. I mean, the southern edge of Lake O, we spoke about it on this program. There were big concerns about the levee holding up, and they were releasing water to the east and to the west, and you had algae bloom, and environmentalists and Everglades supporters and even agriculture community members will look at that and say, listen, that is not effective water management. That is very far from effective water management.
Right, and that's what they were saying to the Corps, is we can't you know, look what happened last summer. We need to get moving on this. Now, keep in mind that if they approve it, it's still going to take years to get done.
Yeah, because this isn't a matter of just rerouting a pipe. We're talking about filling in canals. We're talking about rerouting pipes, no doubt about it. We're talking about levee work. And there's some significant infrastructure that goes into the restoration of water flow to the central Everglades.
Right. This is six projects that's projected to, you know, it's going to take years to get them done. But their point is, we need to start.
What's at stake here? Is it more algae bloom perhaps this summer if we get a wet season? Is it something greater than that?
Well, given that how slowly this stuff moves this summer, they weren't going to have anything done in time this summer.
Anyway.
Right. But what's at stake is, you know, for the foreseeable future, I mean, they can get the stuff done. They need to get it done.
And what about the process at this point? Those who are supporting this Central Everglades replumbing, as Mark put it, a restoration project, like the plan calls it, was all about getting it in front of Congress in June for it to vote on this big omnibus water management bill.
Right.
And is that dead in the water, pun intended?
You know, the governor has called for them to reconvene before their schedule to move that up, even though they've said they're not going to meet again until June. He's saying you need to do it now. Environmentalists are asking them to do it now. It's the core.
Mark, you know? Are you surprised about the state interest and acceptance and, I suppose, effort behind the Everglades after it was left to dry and to rot for generations of politicians?
No. Remember, there's a lot of money here at stake. Not only do you have a lot of contractors who can stand to make millions of dollars off of these various projects, but you have sugar, one of the largest special interests in the state that helps underwrite the legislature's, the individual members and the political parties' various campaigns. So there's a lot there. And in addition to that, developers help fuel the political economy as well, certainly locally. If you don't have enough water to allow for future development or maintain your current development, you got a problem. So there are a variety of financial interests at stake here. And the thing with state government is designed to do stuff faster. There's always that joke that the opposite of pro is con and the opposite of progress is Congress. And we're going to see that. You know, the only thing that's going to make the Army Corps look quick by design is going to be Congress. When the word of bill happens to land in its chamber whenever, you can count on a delay there as well.
Mark Caputo covering politics for the Miami Herald. Jenny Stiletovich with the Miami Herald as well. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Now, while the argument is over not enough water in the Central Everglades, a trio of U.S. officials toured areas of Florida this week that sit right on the edge of the sea. Florida Senator Bill Nelson led this tour, focusing on the threat of rising sea level. One witness in the hearing on Miami Beach was Megan Lincoln from Swiss Re Reinsurance. Now, reinsurance is the insurance that insurance companies go out and get. It plays a key role in the cost of insurance for companies and homeowners.
There could be some assets that become uninsurable, not because we are not able to offer insurance. The industry has plenty of capacity, but because the premium rates might become high, which would lead to consumers not wanting to pay.
So in other words, there'll be plenty of insurance available. It just may not be at prices affordable for anybody. The sea level rise threat exists not just along the beach here in South Florida. In Little Havana, resident Riza Fernandez says she's frustrated by area flooding in her neighborhood and what she sees as the lack of planning for higher seas.
It bothers me because as a city that we want to bring new stadiums, we want to bring the Super Bowl, we want to bring all these things, but yet in infrastructure, we're not really investing for the future. It hurts me as a resident, a native of here.
There is one big infrastructure project, though, that is about to really be launched in a big way, $1.6 billion to repair Miami-Dade sewer system. It does not specifically consider, though, higher seas in the rebuilding, particularly for the Virginia Key Sewage Treatment Plant. Lawyer Albert Slapp is part of a lawsuit against the county sewer rebuilding plan.
The current basis of design is zero sea level rise and zero climate impact protection. If there was a 14-foot storm surge here, you will lose at least 25% of the in-place plant and equipment here will be wiped out. And raw sewage is flowing out into the water. That's what it would look like.
Does not paint a pretty picture here, Jenny. Let's talk about the Senate hearing that came to town. Is there real heft involved? Is there real work that's being done at the federal level regarding sea level rise? Or was this a pony show of sorts?
Well, Senator Nelson said he wanted to get it on record, and that's why he held the hearing and invited witnesses, because he wanted the government's position on climate change, the numbers they have, in the record. Whether there's work behind that, well, it's like the Everglades restoration.
Right. Well, actually, it's not, because at least people agree that the Everglades needs to be restored. You know, there's a significant number of Republicans in Congress who don't believe in man-made climate change, and right. Some don't believe the seas are the, better said, that the globe is warming.
Right. So there's the debate over climate change. The debate over rising seas, to me, seems to be over. I mean, the federal numbers over the past century have shown seas in Miami Beach are 9 inches higher today than they were back in the 1920s.
Sea level is higher. Underestimate denialists' ability to deny reality.
Well, the cause of that is for some reason, some people want to still debate that cause. But that said, Mark, 60% of the United States lives in coastal regions. A significant chunk of the economic activity in the state of Florida comes from South Florida. Are regulators thinking long term? Are they planning long term? This does not seem to be at all on the agenda in the legislative session that's almost wrapped up in Tallahassee.
Oh, not at all. And look to Tallahassee for another bastion of climate change denialism. It certainly exists there as well. So basically, we're going to have to start thinking about geoengineering when it comes to climate change. That is, ways in which we can pollute the atmosphere in a different way to help cool the globe.
But what's interesting, at least back to the politics of addressing this, it's happening to some degree at the local level. Just this week, Palm Beach County approved of the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact. Broward County has been a leader in this. The rebuilding of A1A after Hurricane Sandy was really led by the local municipality accepting and planning for higher seas, not by the State Department of Transportation. So we're seeing certainly local officials begin to act.
Well, and Miami-Dade also has a task force, which is meeting Monday to talk about. They have a draft they're working on. It's a plan.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if we print enough of the plans up, we can then build on top of them and the seas won't be able to reach us.
It is, though, a part also about private industry responding to it. As we heard from the reinsurance executive, there will be financial risks. There are significantly financial risks. And boy, you know, you look at the cranes that are erected on the coast, right on the beach in Miami Beach and in Broward County and elsewhere. There's significant investment happening today. The commercial interests will look at that, Jenny and Mark, and say 3 to 5 years for that return on investment. The owners are looking 20 to 30 years on their return.
This week when we went out with a group of climate people, one of the stops was in Aventura on the beach, and an attorney who's involved in this pointed north and said, between here and Palm Beach County, there's 60 condos set to be constructed. None of them consider climate change because, like you said, developers look 3 to 5 years. Somebody who buys a place is looking 30 years, and he is telling people, you need to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Know? It's not the funders for the developers. It's the folks behind the mortgages for those 60 condominium
buildings. And the irony is the big moneyed interests that are saying, hey, look, you want to buy in this area, we're going to charge you more in insurance. A lot of those, the insurance lobby helps fund the Republican Party, which is in power in the state legislature. And some of those state legislators are like, oh, there's basically no climate change going on. So here we are.
Mark Caputo, here we are indeed. Jenny Stiletovich, both with the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. The Florida Roundup still continues. A rare case of disagreement between Republican leaders in Tallahassee over college tuition and non-documented students. Plus, the end of FCAT. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. A week ago, what looked all but certain now faces an unclear fate as the Florida legislative session has just 1 week left. The momentum to pass a bill allowing undocumented students to pay in-state college tuition at colleges and universities has stalled, exposing a political rift of sorts between Senate President Don Gates and House Speaker Will Weatherford. Governor Scott repeated his support for the bill, though.
Our kids can't afford it. And have students that have grown up in this state not have the same rights to get in-state tuition as their peers is wrong.
But Gates and Weatherford, who have generally worked together during this legislative session, really highlights some of the important differences on this education bill. Your thoughts on allowing undocumented students to pay in-state tuition in the state of Florida. Does that crowd out other deserving students who are documented? Let us know and join the conversation at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or on Twitter at WLRN. Of course, online with our live online discussion at WLRN.org. Mark Caputo and Jenny Stiladovich from the Miami Herald. Sammy Mack covering education for State Impact and WLRN. Mark, first of all, the politics of this. Had we been talking 8 days ago, this thing looked all but certain, at least to get out of one of the legislative houses. Now it's clinging to life.
Right. The politics of it are complex. In though the House and Senate are both controlled by large Republican majorities, understand that human nature is to be very tribal, and there's the Senate Club and there's the House Club. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the session, when the House, the guys in the House want something and the guys in the Senate want something, these tribal disagreements increase. And the end of session is essentially a big card game, and you wind up trading different cards. So what probably happened is Senate President Don Gates is using this bill in part as a trading card to get what he wants.
Sure.
Here's the problem. A lot of the guys in the House are like, what does he want?
Right, that's exactly. If it's leverage, leverage for what? If it's the
right
fulcrum, what is he going to pop it to?
Correct. That's part of the question. And then, you know, Gates added fuel to the fire. One of the things in North Florida, which is where he's from, where I used to live in Tallahassee. One of the things in North Florida that a lot of intellectual people hate is being portrayed as these kind of knuckle draggers mm-hmm. on certain issues. But then, you know, Gates, you know, their own state senator, he releases this letter like, oh, I oppose the Dreamer education bill. It's not about Hispanics. It's the fact that some of these kids hail from terrorist nations.
The phrase was cauldrons of terror.
Cauldrons of terror. And it's like, okay, well, if that's the case, how many of these sleeper agents are going to high school right now whom we're subsidizing? And oh, by the way, you know, Saudi Arabia, which is where 17 of the 19 hijackers are from, is not listed on the state sponsor of terror list, but that's another matter.
And you talk about subsidizing them in high school because presumably they'd be going to public high schools here, which are supported by state dollars.
And the idea that in-state tuition rate is going to keep a sleeper agent who is presumably funded by petrodollars from eventually, you know, hatching his nefarious plot is absurd.
Someone's fishing for red herring at this point. Sammy Mack, though.
Or red meat.
That as well. Sammy Mack, is this an immigration issue? Is this an education issue? It's got to kind of combine both of them together with this in-state undocumented bill.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And part of what's really interesting about what's happening right now is that Rick Scott, Governor Rick Scott, really wants this thing to pass. And, you know, of course, getting the Hispanic vote and support behind this would be probably pretty good for him come election time. But this has been an ongoing fight for years. These kids who have come to the United States as children, who really didn't have any autonomy or say in whether or not they wanted to come to the U.S., their parents brought them here. They've been educated here. They think of themselves in a lot of ways as Americans. And then you talk to them and they tell you, you know, I can't apply for school. I can't afford it. I'd have mm-hmm. to pay out of state tuition, which is much more expensive. And of course, federal loans and those sorts of things aren't available to them. So it's a real hurdle to finishing their education. And they sort of feel like they're in this limbo. So they absolutely want this thing to pass. But it's really up in the air what's going to happen.
Jenny Stiladovich, we've heard voices on this program, however, counter that and say you allow these undocumented workers in-state tuition already in some schools, and it pushes out documented residents. It pushes out other deserving kids from the pool of being accepted at these public universities and allowing to pay in-state tuition. So these legislators really kind of have to dance a little bit of a fine line here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, between trying to address exactly the issues that Sammy talks about on the immigration side and the pushback from those longtime residents and voters of saying, you'll be pushing other kids out. You'll be pushing my kids out, my neighbor kids out, who were born here, who were raised here, who were raised in homes that have been paying property taxes for, you know, the better part of a generation. So I guess the rift, while political in nature, Mark, it does show a bit of a cultural rift, too. Do you agree?
It's a partisan rift. Understand this, is that we obtained a poll that the Republican Party of Florida charted in GOP-controlled state Senate districts. That poll shows that there is overwhelming support to give in-state tuition rates to children of undocumented immigrants who were born here.
Right.
However, children of undocumented immigrants who are not born here, i.e. those who are essentially illegal immigrants, mm-hmm. that is opposed by Republican majorities only. And the opposition to this in the state Senate is in the Republican majority. If this hits the floor, it'll probably pass by anywhere from 21 to 27 votes. The problem is the majority of the GOP caucus opposes this because their voters do. It's democracy. And this is one of the ugly sides of democracy for those who want this bill to pass.
Majority rules. Mark Caputo covering politics for the Miami Herald. This is the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Should undocumented students be allowed to pay in-state tuition at Florida public colleges and universities? Michelle joins us on the telephone from Margate. Michelle, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I think we should have some type of stipulation where these undocumented students should work in the state of Florida after they've graduated. It's almost like a grant type of thing. That way, I think more people would be more willing to accept it, and it would increase possible employment and jobs in the state of Florida.
I suppose it's an interesting idea, Michelle, but I suppose the pushback would be, are you going to guarantee them a job if they're allowed to pay in-state tuition? And if the only job they can find is in the state of Texas, are you going to require them to pay arrears higher tuition of the education which they've already gathered?
That's a good point. I don't know. I know at one point when I was going to school, I got a grant where I had to work in the state where I got the grant for a minimum amount of time. It was 2 years. I did it. I got the money to complete my education. So, I mean, it's only fair. My son's going to be going to school in the next year or so. And, you know, he was born and bred here in Florida. And, there's got to be some equity here.
Michelle from Margate, congratulations on the soon-to-be college student, by the way. But Sammy Mack, kind of an interesting kind of a Florida core kind
right.
of idea.
Hey, Sue, before the before the in-state tuition bill started really tanking, Senator Legg had added an amendment that in order to qualify for this, the students who were asking for the in-state tuition who were undocumented had to provide evidence that they were going to be applying for status, that they were either, if they weren't in a position that they could apply for status, that they were promising that they were going to. And it does get at this idea that, you know, if we are going to give you in-state tuition, that you would, in fairness, really want to be here. And that was sort of a proof of evidence or evidence that he wanted to be attached to that. I will say it's important to note that the universities and schools already have the option to grant right. in-state tuition. So it is an option right now for schools. And Miami-Dade College does this.
Right. And FIU, I believe, does it as well. And what we heard during one of the legislative hearings was a legislator saying for those schools that don't follow through with this, we should hear from these administrators of why they don't. And we haven't necessarily heard from that. We've heard from the students that are able to find the institutions that will allow undocumented students pay in-state tuition. But we haven't heard, Mark, really from the institutions that are not following through with that.
Yeah, in my experience, there are few greater political cowards than the people who run lots of colleges and universities. So that shouldn't be much of a shock. In the end, you know, we are looking in great part at the politics of this, not the policy, because, you know, this is not a lot of students we're talking about.
That's right.
And
there has been a financial argument that was floated a few days ago or maybe late last week or so. But boy, that was shot down quickly because the amount of money that we're talking about with a state with over $1 billion surplus is very, very little.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the person who made the argument about the numbers that got largely shot down and discredited is the Senate budget chairman. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of figure that out. But this is just kind of the raw nature of the way in which politics play out. I mean, the Hispanic vote's 14% of the vote. If this passes, does it mean Rick Scott's going to win the Hispanic vote? No. But it does give him a foot in the door to describe, you know, his outreach, his vision for Florida more to a segment of the electorate that generally has been more hostile to the Republican position than to the Democratic
position.
Will this
be voted on at all before the end of session a week from today?
I think there's a very good chance that there will be a vote on it. Mm. And the template for it was just seen in another immigration-related issue. There was a bill that made it out of the Senate, or it made it into the Senate, I should say, by a voice vote. And it concerned whether the Supreme Court could allow a law license to be awarded to an undocumented immigrant who had gone through school here. And that's the key, is a voice vote. There's a lot of procedural stuff here. The only way that this immigrant tuition bill could probably get taken up in the Senate is by a two-thirds vote. But if it's done on a voice vote, where people don't actually have to go onto the boards, could give some people political cover to allow it to happen.
We are talking about the in-state tuition bill for undocumented students in the state of Florida here on the Florida Roundup. Mark Caputo is with the Miami Herald. Jenny Stiletovich also with the Miami Herald. And Sammy Mack with WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Also on the education policy agenda, the State House gave its approval to a bill that would change the way school systems enter into contracts with charter schools. The Senate has shown no interest in passing it, at least not yet, Sammy. What are the changes that would be included in this bill, however?
Okay, so the House version of this bill would take school districts out of a lot of the negotiating process for the way that charters get set up. And it would also force school districts to share their unused facilities with charter schools. And I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to be happening. The Senate version has stripped all of that basically out of their version of the bill. And basically the only thing that would happen on the Senate version is it would allow charter schools to open on military bases. Mm-hmm. So they're very, very different bills at this point.
And Mark, some are claiming that the bill is unconstitutional. What's the potential issue there?
Well, that's a good question. For me, the real issue here is the horrible nature of the appearance of pay-to-play politics. Manny Diaz, who is a state rep from Miami, works for a charter school company. And Eric Frezen, a state rep from Miami, works for a charter school company. Yes, it's a citizens' legislature. Yes, the legislature is a part-time job. But at a certain point, if you are passing legislation, major legislation that greatly affects the biggest section of the budget, one of the most important political issues, it would probably help that it doesn't feather your financial nest. And that really, in the end, when I hear from state senators whispering about this,
that's even if the legislators vote present or a roll call vote and don't actually take a position on it.
Well, it's kind of unseemly. You're going to make these major changes this late in the session.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, it's something like 50%, and I probably shouldn't quote percentages, a large percentage of general revenue, which is the main part of the state budget, is dedicated to education. If you want to kill yourself as a statewide candidate or a local candidate for office, just start monkeying around with education. And we've got a lot of monkeying around with education here.
We've certainly known for it in the Sunshine State.
Yeah.
Now, if education is your bailiwick, the legislature is your bailiwick, next week, join us for the Sunshine Edition, a full week next week of special coverage in the final days of the session. We will have that all next week, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. right here on WLRN. Well, speaking of monkeying around with education, the FCAT, RIP the FCAT. For the last time, Florida public school students, teachers, and parents sat through what has been that annual rite of spring for 19 years. It was the first time in my household this spring that we went through the FCAT exercise. We didn't have any problems, Jenny Stiletovich. I believe you did, though,
yes,
and you
did.
Were not alone with the glitches. What happened?
Well, I have three children, two in middle school. My daughter took the reading part of the FCAT on Monday and Tuesday. Monday, she was kicked off five times and had to restart the test five times. Tuesday, she had to restart it three times. I will say that her school handled it. She came home unfazed, but we're keeping an eye when the scores come out.
You're ready to appeal.
Yes.
You're ready to appeal. You're not alone. Sammy, we heard a number of different stories of mostly computer glitches, logging on, logging off kind of problems
We
heard in Broward and Dade and Palm Beach counties.
Yeah, there have been problems all over the state, and they had sort of been cropping up a little bit last week, but this week it was to the point where at one point Pam Stewart sent a note to a couple of the Education Commissioner.
Pam Stewart.
Yeah, had sent a note to a couple of the counties saying, you know what, hold off until we figure this out. Pearson, who administers the test, is in a lot of hot water with her. We'll see what happens. They've been fine in the past for those sorts of things. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. But yeah, I have a feeling that a lot of parents are going to probably be appealing, and there will be a lot of outcry when the scores come in, no matter what happens, just because at this point, the sort of trustworthiness of it is in question.
Share your FCAT story with us here on the Florida Roundup if you'd like. Your special FCAT breakfast that you use, your lucky pencil, perhaps, if you're one of the parents of a younger child. What are your memories of FCAT? 1-800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Mark, I know you come from an education household, as do I. We didn't have any problems with my oldest boy's FCAT. Now, he's on the younger side of the FCAT. FCAT, so he was using some analog technology involved in taking this test.
Yeah, you know, humankind has done a great job evolving socially over centuries using pencils and pens and things that make little black
the
marks.
The keyboard
on paper.
Was not mightier than the sword, was
yeah,
it?
That's true. Yeah, you know, the Egyptians invented something called papyrus and paper. You know, their society was rather well involved. You know, at a certain point, we've got to stop finding, you know, solutions in search of a problem. Like, oh, we need to we need to computerize everything. Why don't we just stick with paper? I mean, power goes out. Just look at the disastrous Obamacare rollout by computer. Mm-hmm. You know, computers aren't going to solve all the problems. And, you know, when I went to Florida public school, you know, growing up here, I tested on paper. I think I came out okay.
That's debatable still. And yeah, I know that the listeners will want to debate that,
I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And I do know that when I've taken tests on computers, it's just more maddening. Let's just go back to pencils and paper.
As a young reporter in the upper Midwest in wintertime, when you cover a fire outside, don't bring a pencil. Or rather, bring a pencil. Do not bring a pen because things tend to freeze.
Same thing with hurricanes here. When it rains, right.
Pens do not work.
Use pencils.
That's
yes.
Right. But Sammy, Mark brings up an interesting point nonetheless. Yes, analog.
Nonetheless.
thank you. Analog is not going to break down. You're always going to be able to log on with your number two pencil and your sheet of paper. However, we know that society is moving into a very fast acceptance of technology. And there's also the push for testing efficiency.
Right.
Because it impacts, presumably, the cost.
And the test that we're getting after this, which we still don't have a name for, but the test that we're getting next year that's based on the Common Core standards will be administered on computer. There are a couple of exceptions. But yeah, everything is moving towards computer. And the folks who are in favor of it argue that this is more like the real world skills that you need, and right. That you can do more sophisticated kinds of testing that test the way you relate pieces to each other. We actually have a great video on our State Impact website of what some of the different tests look like compared to the paper versus the computer. But nevertheless, it raises tons of questions, not just about the reliability of the servers and the connections and whether or not the software is working, but also the cost of getting these into every single classroom is something that a lot of districts are struggling with.
We were already debating, or we were already preparing for a debate next spring about this test that's going to replace FCAT and how it's used for grading schools and whatnot. Now, with the glitches in this FCAT, Jenny, are we going to have the same kind of debate about a test that will no longer exist 6, 8, 9 months from now?
If we don't take care of the infrastructure, and I'm just going to chime in as an angry parent, then yes, because the kids are in school. In schools that don't have enough computers. And so when the FCAT rolls around in my kid's school, there's 1,100 kids there. They don't have enough computers, so they set up this crazy scheduling system so that they can move all the kids in to take the test at the appropriate time. So you have some kids sitting in a classroom all day long doing nothing, waiting for their turn to take the test. So you can't force kids to do things on a computer when you don't have the infrastructure in place. It's like telling people, you know, everybody's going to drive cars now, but we don't have any highways.
Yeah, it goes to show you that a lot of people running education policy are pretty stupid. They can't add.
Mark Caputo for the Miami Herald, Jenny Stiletovich, an angry parent, but also
I'm
the Miami
incidentally,
Herald.
I'm also an angry parent and the husband of a public school teacher.
And Sammy Mack with State Impact covering education here on WLRN. Still to come, the passing of a Nobel Prize winning author. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote the book that propelled him into international fame, 100 Years of Solitude, using only his index finger. He spent 6 hours a day for 15 months in Mexico City, fueled by scotch and cigarettes. It has since sold 50 million copies in 30 languages. He died this month at the age of 87. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director at WLRN, with us as well. And Scott Cunningham from O Miami. Welcome, all three of you, to the Florida Roundup. The author, Tim, will be remembered certainly for 100 Years of Solitude, but will he be remembered differently in South Florida because of the politics that he had?
For sure. Like so many prominent Latin Americans, and not just leftists either, Garcia Marquez had this irrational fear, which he wasn't, abashed about expressing. I mean, when I interviewed him a few times in the 1990s, he was very upfront about this. But he had this irrational fear that if you criticized Fidel Castro, you would somehow harm the larger cause of defending Latin American sovereignty against U.S. interventionism. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people, including myself, would argue that ultimately that hurt the Latin American cause, but it was very much a part of the Latin American intellectual scene and culture in the 20th century, that somehow censuring Washington's sins were far more important than acknowledging Castro's sins, especially since Fidel was seen as the only guy standing up to
right.
Washington.
And García Márquez really wanted to see himself as a bridge.
No, of course. I mean, that's,
as a diplomat of sorts.
That's one of the fortunate things, if I could say that, about his passing this month, is that we can now, I think, finally separate his prose and his politics. Mm. And that's important, I think, because American readers, I think, will be able to appreciate his masterful stories without that political filter. I think that's very important because his work is some of the most insightful ever written into not just who Latin Americans are, but who we are in the Americas, mm-hmm. in the New World. And I think, you know, and it'll also be easier to separate the politics because I think in the 21st century that penchant among Latin American intellectuals to blame Washington.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. There's a lot that Washington...
It goes beyond Cuba.
There's a lot that Washington bears blame for in Latin America. Its record, especially in the 20th century in Latin America, particularly its intervention, was very checkered. But this penchant for blaming the U.S. for all of Latin America's troubles, from dictators to inequality, I think a lot of Latin American intellectuals in the 21st century have realized that it wasn't just simplistic, it was also holding back the region's development. And García Márquez's buddies, like Carlos Fuentes mm-hmm. and fellow Nobel laureate Mario Vargas Llosa, they came to realize that. Unfortunately, I don't think García Márquez did.
He was born from Colombia and really produced the art in Mexico. Do you think that, how did that influence the politics?
Mexico was sort of a neutral area back, you know, in the late 20th century. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that in the late 20th century, Mexico was sort of a place that was seen where intellectuals could go, where they could be free to sort of, you know, challenge the U.S., but also challenge a lot of the problems in Latin America as well. And I think that was one of the things that drew writers like García Márquez or Gabo, as he was known, to Mexico City.
From politics and prose to poetry, Scott Cunningham with the O Miami Foundation here. Florida today, Scott, is one step closer to having a state poet laureate. For the first time in many, many years,
it's
making
exciting.
It official. What's the value to Floridians?
I think the value is having a prominent position that you know represents poetry. It says to people in the state that this is something that matters. This is something we care about, and we care about it enough to actually appoint someone and ask them to speak for us in some way.
Alicia Zuckerman, an editorial director here, the politics of this are not to be argued necessarily, but speak to that value of poetry here as we're winding up National Poetry Month, especially in Miami.
Yeah, you know, I think we've seen it through sort of firsthand through these contests that we've done with O Miami for the last several years, and the one we're doing right now, This Is Miami. When you're reading a lot of poetry, when you're thinking about poetry, it kind of changes the lens through which you experience your day-to-day life. We're seeing that a lot through these poems that are coming in. And I think, you know, having a poet laureate, as Scott said, tells people, you know, there's real value in this. It's not just about all of the other sort of pedestrian things that you have to deal with in life, but it's worth it to take a step back and process sort of what it all means through a literary lens.
Scott, I think by all accounts, the O Miami Festival in the month of April over the course of the last several years that you've shepherded poetry to the community has been a resounding success. Where did the idea come from?
Oh, man.
What was the kernel?
I think the kernel was I sat down and wrote kind of like a two-day thing that I wanted to do that was like panels and lectures, and it was exactly the same thing that you'd see in almost any city. And I took a look at it and I said, this will never work in Miami. You know, this is a town where we have to beg people to go to baseball games. There's no way I'm going to get people to go to a poetry reading and lectures and panels. So I said, all right, well, what's the opposite of that? And that's where it came from.
And it has led to the contest we're doing this month here on WLRN that we posed, write a poem, use the phrase, this is where, and we got dozens upon dozens of entries, including this one.
This is where a man stepped on a manatee and died of a heart attack. His obituary might be written in Spanglish next to an ad for a strip club. And the tourists won't know that he was found naked, straddling the ocean, waterlogged like Gossam columns, bloated like the yellow pages. We will mourn him in the burnt coffee of Monday. We will bury him in the smoke of our father's cigars.
The burnt coffee of Monday. What a great phrase there. Breaking News was the title of that poem from Serafima Fedorova of Miami Beach. Scott, what strikes you about that poem?
Sign that kid up. Where is she? I want her number. No, that's one of the best poems I've heard for one of these contests. That was great.
Waterlogged like gossip columns, bloated like the yellow pages.
She nailed so many things about Miami, and she nailed them in images, not in cliches. I mean, that was what was so striking about it, was that all of it was familiar to me, but within the context of the poem, it was made new again.
You know, what's great, what I've enjoyed about reading these This Is Where poems, Alicia, is that even these locations that may no longer be around, businesses and some taverns or some, you know, roadways, inns, those kind of things, you can see them, you can smell them, you can taste them through the language that South Floridians have put on the computer screen in this case.
Yeah, and I would venture to say that it's maybe even more important here. It's especially important in a place like South Florida, where there is such a transient population, where people come and go so much that sometimes you lose that institutional memory that some other cities have. And so this is kind of how we both hold on to that, but also learn about it. Like, I didn't know that there used to be apparently a great theater on 163rd Street in North Miami Beach, but one of the poems is about that theater and really painted the picture. The poet writes about the icy air and the magical screen and, you know, icy air, like, this is South Florida, right? Icy air. But then, yeah, like, that's the experience of living here. You come in, you have to, like, come out from the cold here because it's so air conditioned all the time.
Yep, the theater's still there. Steve Pollack from Miami wrote this poem particularly.
Heaven had 1,265 cushy seats, all the icy air you could breathe and the magical screen, more vast than a South Florida summer. Then a shortage of angels, when they, those bastards, cut heaven in two. The twinning struck like hellfire in 1983, down the middle of the 163rd Street Theater, in a misnamed suburb, neither North Miami nor Beach. This is where they downsized Hollywood dreams.
Split it right in half. The misnamed suburb, neither North Miami nor Beach. Scott, that wraps up This Is Where right there.
Yeah, it really does. He sounded like he was going to cry there at one point.
Well, you know, like a great old theater that you feel really attached to, if it changes, if suddenly it's a multiplex or even a duplex, the experience is different and it doesn't exist anymore, but it exists in this poem.
And that's so much, I think, of our experience here in South Florida, where you're talking about the loss of institutional memory. Is a lot of that has also happened with the loss of actual institutions, you know,
things being
bulldozed and taken down.
The Van Dyke, the vagabonds going.
Yeah, things just disappearing and no one remembers them unless we write poems about them.
Well, and it is particularly writing poems. I mean, Tim, you know, in your job, you know, you're looking at really the world through the lens of South Florida into Latin America, and putting the lens of poetry over South Florida as a longtime resident forces one to think about this community in a much different way than you would if it was purely prose on the front page or on a radio newscast.
Well, I think South Florida, for example, is one of the few places in the United States where people do bring a little bit of that magical realist sensibility that Garcia Marquez and so many other Latin American authors were trying during the 20th century to get Americans to assimilate a little bit more. You know, Garcia Marquez, I think he always felt that if Americans would just absorb a little bit more of that humane, magical realist sensibility that he brought to his stories, maybe we wouldn't be supporting so many dictators. And you know, again, that's simplistic, but that's just the way things were back then.
Burnt coffee of Monday and the waterlogged like gossip column certainly provide some kind of magical realism here in South Florida. Scott, judge, you know, the level of success, your goal of exposing South Florida to poetry for at least 1 month per year.
It's been amazing this year. It really has been. And this is where a contest has really been at the center of it. But we've had such an amazing response, and it just proves to me again that there's so much creativity and imagination here in South Florida, and so many people who really care about where they live.
Yeah, all fueled by the sunshine here in South Florida, no doubt about it. Now, you can go online to WLRN.org, and we're asking you to enjoy the poetry, the This Is Where poetry. Vote for your favorite among the selection of This Is Where poems. And then you can also join us on April 30th, and you can find out who won the vote, as a matter of fact. All four poems will be chosen by Scott. You'll be one of the judges here, as a matter of fact, right?
I am very honored to be one.
Are you ready to sift through the lines and lines of poetry here in the hours ahead?
I'm ready.
All right. All five winners will be announced at our poetry reading finale Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. at Miami Club Rum. We'll have some food and refreshments. You can RSVP on our website, again, WLRN.org. Scott Cunningham with Oh Miami, Alicia Zuckerman with WLRN, and Tim Padgett with WLRN. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Finally on the program, we're sad to announce the passing this week of our own man inside the radio, Rich Davis. Davis hosted Sound of the Caribbean on WLRN Wednesday through Sunday. He died in the country in which he was born, Jamaica. Cause of death has yet to be determined, but family members confirm he had a history of hypertension. Rich is survived by two siblings, his mother, a longtime partner, and 4-year-old son. He was 41 years old. We spoke to several South Florida fans about the man inside their radio.
Welcome once again to Sounds of the Caribbean. If you're in my town, your town, or some of the town, we welcome you on board. Grab your hat, grab your coat, put on your shoes, head to the door. Let's go for the ride.
Rich was just one of those truly South Florida kind of characters. He just had this incredible voice, this, you know, great accent from the Caribbean, amazing music and flavor from all over the region. You know, in a way, it's the kind of show that you would hope to find on the air if you're driving down the highway late at night in South Florida. It was exactly who you wanted to hear.
You know, a lot of us were asleep, but there was another sector of people that was awake. The truck drivers, the guys who do the delivery at wee hours in the morning, because I know a lot of friends who does stuff like that, and they always talk about him. So, you know, for me, I know he was reaching the community that way.
On a personal level, I didn't really know anything about Rich Davis, right? And it's just amazing when I heard of his passing, just basically, wow, you know, like it actually hit me, like, there was a bond there. So it's just kind of a strange thing, you know, because it's not like a celebrity type person. It was just this very honest person that, you know, had, I'm sure, countless influence and friends and was loved by many. And it kind of hit home today, you know.
He was not just playing the role of, oh, you know, I'm a DJ, I'm a broadcaster, I'm just playing music. He was interested, he was genuinely interested in my career, and he would play my songs and he would make sure that they were heard. He would be like, this is good, you know, look out for her, you know, because he believes in my stuff, and that meant a lot to me. And he would really try to make me feel comfortable that don't give up, it's worth it, just keep going. So that really meant a lot to me, and I'll never forget it.
Sounds of the Caribbean with Rich Davis.
The man inside your radio.
Remembering Rich Davis, the man inside your radio, here at WLRN, dead at the age of 41. Our thoughts, hopes, and prayers with him, his family, and his friends. This is the Florida Roundup for April 25th, 2014. Join us next week, all next week at 9 a.m., our special coverage of the legislative session here on WLRN, the Sunshine Edition, at 9 a.m. beginning Monday. The Florida Roundup is produced by Lane Shin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Stay tuned. Ed Bell and South Florida Arts Beat is next. We will hear from you Monday morning at 9 a.m. for the Sunshine Edition. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.